Imagine you are lying in your bed of a morning. What time of the day was this?
12:45.
And this comes through the roof and hits you.
That's Gary Moore, the host of a 1950s game show called I've Got a Secret. He's talking to Ann Hodges as he holds the meteorite that hit Ann in her Alabama home in 1954. What happens when you become the only human being to survive a meteorite striking you? In Ann's case, you find yourself thrown into a media spotlight you never wanted, and you learn that fame can cause more damage to a person than a meteorite landing on your hip. This is the story of the star that fell on Ann Hodges. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark, all the troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. The song Stars Fell on Alabama has been recorded by more than 100 artists. The song tells the story of lovers in a field of white, kissing as the stars fell on Alabama last night. Versions have been recorded by Frank Sinatra, Doris Day, Harry Connick Jr., and one of my personal favorites, the Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald version. The earliest known recording was by the Guy Lombardo Orchestra in 1934. That's the year the song was written and became a hit.
I never planned in my imagination a situation so heavenly, a fairyland where no one else could enter, and in the center, just you and me, dear. My heart beat like a hammer, my arms wound around you tight, and stars fell on Alabama last night.
Years later, Stars Fell on Alabama would become the Alabama state motto. The song paints such a dreamy picture, but the event that inspired the name of the song struck fear in the heart of Alabamians. The song was inspired by a book of the same name that released in 1934. Written by Carl Carmer, the book tells the story of a meteor shower, more like a meteor storm, that occurred over 2 days in Alabama in November of 1833. Meteor showers can be such magical events for us these days. Some of us schedule the time to view them, even head to a special place that affords us the perfect view of a meteor shower. But in 1833, this kind of meteor shower was pretty scary. People didn't really know what it was. According to AL.com, astronomers estimate that the meteor storm bombarded Earth's atmosphere with more than 30,000 meteors an hour blazing over Alabama and much of the country. Bill Cook is an astronomer at NASA's Marshall Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. This is how he described the 1833 event to AL.com. The sky was literally filled with fireworks, and people thought it was the end of the world. That was the night stars fell on Alabama and most of North America. People who were alive when this happened were known to refer to life events not by exact years, but as before the stars fell or after the stars fell. Over 100 years later, an Alabama woman would come to define her life as before the meteorite hit her and after the meteorite hit her. To understand the story, we need to take a step back to make sure you know the difference between a meteor, a meteoroid, and a meteorite. The names describe the very same object, but just at different stages. When a rock is floating through space, it's a meteoroid. When it enters the Earth's atmosphere, it heats up and glows as it's smashed into molecules. That shining bright rock we see, that's a meteor, the shooting stars, as we often call them. A meteorite, that's the part of a meteor that makes it to Earth, that lands here. In November of 1954, an 8.5-pound meteorite crashed through the ceiling of the Oak Grove, Alabama home of Eugene and Ann Hodges. The meteorite hit Anne, and that day history was made. Anne became the first person known to be hit by a space rock and survive, with records of the event being recorded, analyzed, and confirmed by military and government officials. The home where this historic event happened was just off Old Birmingham Highway. It's long gone, but a historical marker stands as a reminder of the November day when history fell on Oak Grove. A reminder of how miraculous it was that Anne was hit by that rock and survived. The idea of a meteor falling from the sky and killing a person, even an animal, is rare, but there are many recorded close calls and a few incidents. In February of 2013, a meteor that's estimated to be about the size of a six-story building broke up over a city in central Russia. The blast was stronger than a nuclear explosion, triggering detections from monitoring stations as far away as Antarctica. The blast injured more than 1,000 people, cost $33 million in damage. Those who were injured weren't struck by any of the resulting meteorites. Their injuries were caused by the glass that shattered due to the force of the explosion. A meteorite disrupted a funeral in 1924. Another, a wedding in 1929. One of the strangest incidents involving a meteorite happened in this century. In 2007, villagers in Peru became ill after a meteorite hit near their village and in turn released toxic arsenic fumes from the ground. Since the Hodges incident of 1954, we know of at least two accounts of people being struck by small fragments from a meteorite. In 1992, a small fragment, less than half a pound, struck a boy in Uganda. The boy was uninjured thanks to the size of the fragment and the fact that it passed through large banana trees before it hit his head. In June of 2009, what's been described by a German family as a pea-sized meteorite struck their teenage son, burning his skin. Neither of these accounts have been confirmed by military or government officials, but both were well documented. Now, if you're a numbers person, you should know it's hard to offer an exact probability of your chance of being hit by a meteorite because it's so rare. Tulane University Earth Science Professor Stephen Nelson estimates your odds of dying from a meteorite, asteroid, or comet impact at about 1 in 1.6 million. Michael Reynolds is an astronomer and a meteorite expert. In an interview with National Geographic, Reynolds notes how rare this event was. He shared that the odds of a meteorite striking a populated area, let alone an individual, are staggeringly remote. You'd have a better chance of getting hit by a tornado, a bolt of lightning, and a hurricane all at the same time. But it happened to Anne, and she survived, which many people consider to be an absolute miracle, or at the very least, an incredible stroke of luck. But if you had the chance to talk to Anne Hodges or her husband Eugene, they would tell you that rock that landed on Anne didn't bring luck. It was the beginning of the end for them, the destruction of a marriage, and ultimately a slow end to a life. This November will mark 65 years since residents in parts of Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi witnessed a meteor explosion. Just after noon on November 30th, 1954, 911 lines in Morgan, Talladega, Coleman, and other East Alabama counties were flooded with calls from residents who told operators they had seen some kind of bright light, an explosion in the sky. They were concerned a plane may have crashed. It had been a clear day, but the sky turned dark, and people were afraid, unsure of what was going on. Some describe what they had seen as what appeared to be a gigantic welding arc accompanied by a loud explosion and a brown cloud. Others reported seeing a bright reddish-green light, like a Roman candle, trailing smoke. Months after the event, an Alabama newspaper ran a feature on residents who had seen the meteor explosion. Truck driver Ernest Yeatman shared that he was driving up a steep hill when he saw the object, which seemed to be coming straight down. He described it as a white ball with a long trail of fire. There was still sky visible beneath it when it disappeared. Mr. Yeatman said the whole experience lasted just fractions of a second, although the smoke trail lingered. Fred Nickel was driving home from lunch when he saw the flash that he said looked like a ball of fire, which all of a sudden disintegrated and poured out smoke. Mr. Nickel called the newspaper on the day of the event to report what he'd seen, but he asked them to not quote him unless somebody else had witnessed it, saying folks might think he was just seeing things. Imagine witnessing something strange and potentially harmful happening like this in 1954. You have no smartphone to record videos or take photos of anything you're seeing. No social media to rush to see if other people were experiencing what you had just experienced, if anyone knew what had just happened. Alabama in 1954, the United States in 1954, was still adjusting to television in homes, and news wasn't immediately relayed and accessible to residents as it is today. There were nationwide fears about atomic bombs, fears of a potential invasion of aliens from outer space, fears of a Soviet invasion. It was an unsure time in America, and for residents in these rural Alabama counties, there was immediate fear and concern over what they had witnessed. The fear was understandable, but it's one thing to be a witness. It's quite another to feel the impact of a large meteorite. Eugene and Ann Hodges lived in a white frame home on Odin's Mill Road in Oak Grove, Alabama. The home was across the road from the Comet Drive-In Theater. Just after noon on that historic November day, 34-year-old Ann wasn't feeling well. She was at home with her mother and decided to lay down and rest on the sofa. She felt a chill, so she wrapped herself in several quilts. Ann fell asleep on her right side on the couch in her front room. And within an hour, she woke to the sound of something crashing into her home and a burning sensation on her left hand and her left hip. Ann was dazed and confused. She had been in a deep sleep and some kind of explosion had happened. It took a moment to process it all. At first, she thought the chimney had fallen because there was dust filling the room. Her mother, who had been sewing in a nearby room, rushed into the living room because she thought a gas heater had exploded. She looked over to see Ann standing and reaching for her left side. Ann's mother rushed outside and saw a black cloud in the sky, but nothing around the house was on fire or appeared damaged. Ann's mother re-entered the home and realized the damage, well, it was inside. Ann was staring at what appeared to be a large rock on the floor of the living room. The rock was about the size of a large grapefruit, was very warm to the touch, and smelled of sulfur. The rock had come crashing through the ceiling, bounced off of a console radio in the room, and then struck Ann's left hip and left hand. Prior to penetrating the roof, the meteorite had a calculated velocity of approximately 167 miles per hour. Because the meteorite struck the roof, walls, and the console radio first, analysts would later explain that the meteorite's kinetic energy had essentially been damped to zero when it struck Ann Hodges. Ann and her mother had no idea what had happened or if it would happen again, so Ann called the police and the fire department. When the chief of police, W.D. Ashcraft, arrived at the home and saw the bruise on Ann's hand and learned the rock had struck her hip, he took her to the doctor for a complete examination. Doctors x-rayed Ann's injuries and released her a few hours later, despite her left hand, left hip, and abdomen being sore and quite swollen. But no bones had been broken. Ann returned home to find reporters and sightseers already moving in to try to get into her yard. Her husband, Eugene, had been working about 30 miles from home, clearing trees from telephone lines in Alexander City. He and some of the crew members he was working with heard an explosion that day, but they were hard at work, and Eugene said they were so focused on their work, it didn't seem like a big deal. It wasn't until hours later, when Eugene was driving home for the day, that a neighbor saw him, flagged him down to tell him something had happened at his house. Something had hit his wife. He rushed towards his home, only to find there was a traffic jam on the road leading there because by this time, about 200 people were trying to access that house. Many of them reporters trying to get the scoop of the day, the story of what had happened inside the Hodges home. When Eugene finally made it to the house, he had to push people out of the way to get in the front door to check on his wife. Ann Hodges was a shy woman, so shy and reserved that she was overwhelmed by the crowds that had gathered so quickly. She tried to rest that night, but wasn't able to. People kept coming, trying to talk to her, get interviews, get photos. She was in a lot of pain and had experienced a physical and mental shock. You know how your injuries usually hurt more the morning after you've been hurt? Well, that was the case for Ann Hodges. She slept very little, and when she woke up the next morning, she found a large bruise about the size of a pineapple on her left hip and abdomen, which showed the imprint of the meteorite. This, despite Ann having been cuddled up under two heavy quilts when she was hit. Ann maintained that those quilts helped save her from more serious injuries. Ann was in pain and needed to escape the wild scene at her house. Doctors admitted her to Sylacauga General Hospital for 5 days of rest from the excitement that had become too much for her. Ann would get more rest at the hospital, but for weeks after the incident, she required several hours of daily bed rest and suffered severe pain. As Ann recuperated, military and government officials evaluated and analyzed that rock. Before Chief Ashcraft took Ann Hodges to the hospital on the day she had been struck, he asked her if he could hold on to the rock as part of the investigation. Ann never imagined that this decision would lead to untold stress and ultimately a legal battle. The Sylacauga Chief of Police, along with the town's mayor, Ed Howard, showed the rock to a government geologist who had been conducting field work in their area. The geologists identified the rock as a meteorite, but Howard and Ashcraft wanted to be absolutely sure, and the government wanted to know more about it too. Government officers from Maxwell Field in Montgomery asked to analyze the rock. The military had concerns that the rock could be part of some attempt on the part of the Soviets to attack Americans and worried that it could mean future attacks were imminent. The officers at Maxwell Field worked with the Air Force intelligence authorities to analyze the rock. They confirmed it was indeed a meteorite, and there were no further concerns. But the military didn't return the rock to Alabama. Instead, they sent it to the Smithsonian Institute, where curators were excited to have a meteorite. But who owns a meteorite? If one landed on you, could you keep it? Should it have been returned, or did the government have the right to do what they wanted to do with it? The answer to that question was complicated, and it would take a while to find a resolution. But first, the Hodges wanted the Smithsonian to return the meteorite to Alabama. The museum initially refused, but with the help of Alabama Congressman Kenneth Roberts, the meteorite was returned to the state. And from there, a legal battle over who owned that rock would lead to the public taking sides in a very heated debate. It seemed simple enough. The meteorite landed on Ann Hodges, landed in her house. She firmly believed it was hers to keep. As she told one reporter, she felt like God intended it for her because it hit her. And it didn't hurt that there was nationwide interest in that meteorite and the woman who made history as the only person to survive a direct hit from one. Folks felt there was money to be made off of that rock and the story behind it. Ann wasn't the only person who believed the meteorite was hers. You see, Ann and Eugene Hodges didn't own their home. They rented from their landlady, Bertie Guy. Initially, Bertie didn't make claims on the meteorite, but when she learned the cost of repairs that would need to be made to her home due to the damage the meteorite had caused, her lawyer advised her to step in and make that claim. He told her if she had the rock, she could at least sell it to cover the cost of home repairs. When word got around that Bertie Guy was trying to take Ann Hodges' meteorite from her, the public took sides, with a vocal and passionate majority siding with Ann Hodges. Many people wrote letters to Bertie Guy telling her she needed to drop her lawsuit and let Ann have the rock, and Ann received hundreds of letters of support. As word of what happened to Ann Hodges spread, she was invited to appear in Life magazine and on a popular 1950s game show called I've Got a Secret. The panel would be introduced to a guest, and they would ask questions trying to figure out this person's secrets. It didn't take long for panelists to work out that Ann Hodges was the woman who had been in the news so much because she had been hit by a meteorite. Ann was allowed to bring along the meteorite when she appeared on the show, and the host, Gary Moore, was excited to hold the now famous rock and brought up the litigation when Ann appeared. Here's his exchange with Ann.
First time I've ever seen a star or a hunk of a star, anything like it. It's almost amazing, you know, it's a little awe-inspiring. I understand there's also litigation involved. Who claims they now own the meteorite?
Well, the landlady says it's hers.
The landlady?
Because it came through her roof.
Yes.
But it landed on your hip, didn't it?
That's right.
Well, I tell you what, I probably shouldn't take any sides in this. I ain't no lawyer, but I claim if you're lying in bed and a meteorite comes along and hits you, but if it happened to me, I'd say it was my meteorite, is the way I...
Gary Moore was on Ann's side. Lots of folks were. But it turns out the law was on Bertie Guy's side. Three separate court decisions stated that a meteorite belongs to the owner of the land on which the impact occurred. The Hodges were tenants and Bertie Guy the owner. Therefore, the meteorite was the legal property of Bertie Guy. Once that decision was handed down, folks were upset. As the news made papers across the country, more and more people wrote letters supporting Ann. Ann's husband, Eugene, was convinced the couple could make a lot of money from the incident, and the rock was key. So the Hodges threatened Bertie Guy. They told her they would sue her for the injuries Ann sustained from Bertie Guy's rock in Bertie Guy's house. That threat got them all around the table to talk it out. Bertie Guy agreed to an out-of-court settlement. In exchange for $500, the meteorite and its ownership rights were returned to Ann on September 22, 1955. Eugene and Ann had to borrow $500 from a friend to pay out that settlement. They were happy to do it because they believed they could make that much and a lot more once they had the rights returned to them. Soon after, the Smithsonian offered to buy the rock for what Eugene considered to be too little money. He had folks who had made him other offers, some offering up to $5,500. During the whole litigation process over that rock, public interest in the historic event had waned a bit. It's just how news cycles work. When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, well, you know. Folks stop offering to pay you money for your meteorite. And they stop offering to pay you money to make appearances and do interviews to talk about your meteorite. The event that made Ann Hodges famous led to Ann just making a few hundred dollars. You see, by the time she had ownership of the meteorite, the lawsuit had been bad publicity for Bertie Guy and Ann and Eugene Hodges. People backed off, and no further offers came in. The Hodges used the meteorite as a doorstop in their home until March of 1956, when Ann decided it was time to get the rock out of her house. It hadn't brought about the best luck. She donated the meteorite to the Alabama Museum of Natural History. The Hodges thought this meteorite was going to be their moneymaker, that they would be able to make a fortune and live a very different life. But that rock, well, it shattered more than the roof, caused more pain than they could have imagined. It shattered hopes for the future. It shattered the sense of safety and simplicity of life that Ann and Eugene had known before this event. And it shattered Ann. The mental and emotional stress of the meteorite hitting her, the overwhelming media attention, it seemed to tear at Ann, little by little. She was such a shy and reserved woman. Within less than a year, she had gone from living this simple and quiet life in small town Oak Grove, Alabama, to appearing in Life magazine, the New York Times, and on nationwide TV. All of that attention was attention Ann wished she never had. You see, the bruises on Ann's hands and her hip faded with time. Her body healed, but emotionally, she would never heal from the shock of fame that came so quickly and the disappointments that followed. Ann's marriage was a victim of that meteorite. It didn't survive. Eugene and Ann separated and divorced in 1964. They cared for each other, but they acknowledged that the whole meteorite event and the drama that followed disrupted their marriage. They would say many times they wished it had never happened. Ann suffered a nervous breakdown, and her health declined. The 54-year-old was an invalid living in a nursing home in Sylacauga when she died in 1972. There was one man who would tell folks that he considered the meteorite event of 1954 to be lucky. His name, Julius Kempis McKinney. The day after the meteorite struck the Hodges house, this farmer was driving his mule-drawn wagon, hauling a load of firewood to sell a few miles away. His mules hesitated when they reached what appeared to be a black rock in the middle of the road. McKinney walked up to it, kicked the rock off to the side of the road, and went on about his business. Later in the day, he heard the news about what had happened over at the Hodges house. He went back to the road, found the rock he had kicked off to the side, and picked it up, just in case it was somehow related to the big event. McKinney was friends with a postman who told him he should talk to a lawyer about it, arranged for him to meet with one. The lawyer had the rock analyzed and confirmed to be a 3-pound, very small part of the Hodges meteorite. Julius McKinney sold that rock to an attorney from Indianapolis who made the purchase on behalf of the Smithsonian. McKinney never disclosed how much money he earned from that sale. All we know is that it was enough to improve his situation. He was able to purchase a car and a new home for his family. Eugene Hodges died in January of 2012. In 2004, he was interviewed by Adam Jones of the Tuscaloosa News. He told Jones that he was glad the meteorite remained in Alabama. As he put it, he'd rather it be in a safe place than somebody making money off of it at his expense. You can still see the Hodges meteorite in its safe place alongside the radio that was hit before the meteorite made contact with Ann. They're on display at the Museum of Natural History in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Once a year, in October, a guard transports that meteorite from Tuscaloosa to Oak Grove for the community's annual homecoming festivities, a testament to the lingering fascination with the Hodges meteorite, an 8-pound rock that ended up being one of the biggest things to ever hit Alabama.
We lived our little drama. We kissed in a field of white. And stars fell on Alabama last night. I can't forget the glamour. Your eyes held a tender light. And stars fell on Alabama last night.
Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. You can see photos of Ann Hodges, see her full appearance on Gary Moore's I've Got a Secret, and find much more about this episode in the full show notes at southernmysteries.com. If you're enjoying Southern Mysteries, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a review where you listen so others can discover these stories. And I hope you'll consider leaving a tip to help support Southern Mysteries. To do that, to leave a tip, simply download the free Radio Public app on iOS or Android. The folks at Radio Public have made it easy for you to directly support Southern Mysteries from within their app. You can tap the tip button on my podcast page and leave me a one-time tip for any amount up to $100. Any amount you tip will go directly towards fees associated with producing and hosting the show and towards upgrading equipment to continue to produce Southern Mysteries. Thanks for listening.